Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
So hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm. I'll be one of your hosts. The other host is my good friend, Doug Hagren. Hey, Doug.
Hey, good morning, Kirk. Hey, listen, don't you be discriminating against those Google users out there. YouTube, it might be a minority, or maybe not, but
we can't call them minorities anymore, Doug.
A disadvantaged group? I don't know what you call Google users anymore, but anyway.
People of another color? I don't know. We got to call them something.
Well, yeah, LinkedIn's blue, so one of them's red, maybe.
There are people of another color, right? They're not people of color, they're people of another color. So
that's right.
There blue, you red, you know, I'm sure Twitter's blue too. So we'll all figure it out eventually.
We lost the three people listening to us now. We're done. So let's talk heroin again, Kirk, and that'll get them back. So for those of you that are listening that I haven't heard before, it seems to be a running joke from a mistake, a little word salad that I couldn't exactly communicate on a show, I don't know, several months ago. So, hey, every once in a while, we just throw heroin back in to have a little fun.
Yes, heroin is always fun unless you're taking it, then it's not fun. So we don't advise that. That's, don't try this at home.
Yes. Stay off meth, kids.
All right. Well, let's dive right in before everybody starts tuning out. What are we going to talk about this week? Oh, here's what we're going to talk about. There's so much every week to talk about. You know, what's funny is I put out these posts like, here's what we're going to talk about next week. And every week it's like, we're going to talk about housing. And then we never get to it because there's so much new stuff every single week that is just blowing housing out of the water. As bad as that is, and we will get to housing, there's always something else. So rather than omitting housing again, let's just start there. Doug, you sent me a great article by, I forget which magazine it was, or I just don't want to give him credit, but it was talking about how somebody won a Nobel Prize, I think it was in 93, and it was Robert Shiller. And what he said was, don't own a home. It's a terrible investment. What do you think, Doug?
I got in a conversation with someone this morning about this. And I do these studies all the time because I like to make a joke and I like to respond sometimes on communications with individuals, but period, math, period. Because the reality is that a lot of people live in these bubbles of what they think they know is true. And when you get into the math and science of it, it turns out not to be true. And there is a lot of people, especially in the world of real estate, where people are absolutely convinced about certain returns and appreciation and ultimately the end all be all of the wonderful value that you get in real estate. And listen, I'm not here to dog real estate whatsoever. As a matter of fact, investment real estate overall, it can be a great thing, can be an incredible part of somebody's allocation. And there is certainly lots to be said about the number of billionaires, not just millionaires, but billionaires. Now, incredible numbers of millionaires that have been created because of real estate. But when we're talking about real estate, there really needs to be an understanding between the difference between investment real estate and your residence. Your residence is just a place to sleep. And, you know, do you rent or do you buy? Well, the reality is it's the same thing. What do you mean the same thing? You're still paying someone else for the right to sleep. That's what it is. And so there has become this, I think, this muddying of what is real estate, what is real estate investment. And when it comes down to it, there is mathematically a big difference between investment real estate, which is something that you are putting out a cost, but getting a return on. You are getting the rent income and the appreciation, and you're creating a business from this and what that compounds to a rate of return. That's why real estate investors are always talking about cap rate. What am I going to get in return on this property for what I'm putting down? Residential real estate is a completely different beast. And unfortunately, like I said, but math. When you take a look at it, what has happened is, and I see this all the time in conversations, you know this, Kirk, when we talk about rates of return in markets, people will sit there and they'll look at, you know, a person that has a $10,000 portfolio who gets a 10% rate of return says, well, I only made $1,000. It's a 10% rate of return, lots of money. It doesn't seem like much to them though. It's only $1,000, but it's 10%. You take someone with $1 million portfolio and they get $100,000 in growth. And that person at 10,000 is going, well, I'm not making any money. You're making the same. It's 10% of what you have. And it's the same concept that you'll see with someone that has a 10,000 that goes into a losing 10% economy and they lose $1,000. You know, someone that started there and now they have $1 million and they lose $100,000. Like, I'm losing so much money. It's all the same. Look at the dollar amount and they don't understand percentages. And this is so difficult for many people to comprehend. when you start looking at real estate, what a lot of people have done is they look and generationally in the past, they say, look, we bought this thing and we bought it for $250,000. It's now worth $500,000. I've made so much money, right? Real estate, because you can see it. You can feel it when you sell it. When you buy it, you sell it. It's a different value. But there's something called the Rule of 72, Kirk, and you know this. And for those of you listening, you can find out how many years it takes for something to double by taking 72 divided by a rate of return. And so if you have someone who's owned a house for 24 years and it went from $250,000 to $500,000, it sounds like a lot of money. Look, I made so much money in this. But guess what? The Rule of 72 says if you took something divided by a percentage, it doubles over a certain period of time. But guess what? 72 divided by 3% is about 24 years. So guess what? Yes, it sounds like a lot, but the real rate of return on it was only about 3%. And what Robert Shiller came out, and he won a Nobel Prize for this, is he went back and looked at what is housing really made. Now, again, there's two parts of this, understanding percentages and growth. And you look at the numbers and say, well, I made a lot of money. Well, if you made that money over 24 years, it really wasn't a lot of growth. It's not necessarily as much or anywhere close to what you actually could have made in other places when you compare them, but you see that money, you feel that money. But he went a step further and said, now let's look at what it costs to hold on to it. And people don't really factor that in. They say, well, I bought it at 250,000. It's now worth 350,000. I've made 100,000. Well, what about the $30,000 you had to put in landscaping? What about the new roof you spent $20,000 on? You know, the house that I bought a couple years ago, thankfully they found it during our close, but we had to redo the septic system. That's $26,000 investment there that thankfully the seller had to pay. But again, that went into her profit. And you start looking at all the costs it takes to hold on to it. Now you've got realtor fees to sell it, and you've got closing costs, and you've got taxes, and you've got all these things that you pay as a homeowner. Now, as a renter, you don't pay it. Okay, you don't have any of that. You pay your rent. But most people will look at their mortgage price versus their rent price. They'll look at the money they make on it, but they don't account for all of the money that goes into holding. It's very expensive to hold on to. And if it's residential real estate, you're paying it yourself. You're not getting a renter to pay all this. You are. So when we take a look at the real numbers and you start looking at, I mean, even some of the hottest markets like Denver, I did an analysis for someone recently. They held their house for 15 years in Denver, which has been one of the hottest markets in America. Would you agree, Kirk?
Smoking hot.
He was shocked to find out that his real internal rate of return after appreciation, after all of the investment of money that went into his house, he's made it the last 15 years, about 4%. Okay, that's it, internal annual rate of return. Now, 4%'s not bad, but guess what? That was during one of the biggest real estate booms we've ever seen. So now average that out. And what Robert Shiller went and looked at is he said, if we go back to 1890, basically from right after the end of the Civil War to present, growth in real estate is non-existent. Now, at the top level pricing, it is. You've made money and it's outpaced inflation. But when you start taking into consideration all of the costs that go into acquiring it, to maintaining it, to liquidating it, ultimately, at the end, all of those costs give back all of your gains and growth. It basically is nothing. It's basically holding on to an zero inflation adjusted asset. Now, I got an argument because someone said, well, that just means, you know, rent versus buy. No, it's not a rent versus buy. And we've talked about this the last couple of weeks. Rent versus buy has very much to do right now with the market you're in and what vacancies are and what's available. You need a place to sleep. It's housing. But let's not mistake housing for an investment. The numbers just aren't there. Real estate is a great investment, but your house is a whole different beast. The place you lay your head at night.
I wrote a set of blog posts, I think it was like three or four of them 8 years ago. So I was going through this process with a client of mine, and she was looking at buying a home, which of course everybody does. It was like, oh, I need to buy a home. So I started looking around and I was like, oh, well, have you looked at this town? Have you looked at this town? And I noticed a few things, that there was one home that was for listed for sale and for rent. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. The home was for like $1.4 million at the time, which was actually a pretty expensive home at the time. Now it's just like average around here. Real estate's so crazy. And they were renting it out for $4,000 a month. I had to double take. I'm like, am I missing something? Are they missing a digit? There's no way this is going for $4,000 a month for this place. I mean, the thing was awesome. So I started doing the math and I was like, wow, this is more of a bargain than I even thought. And it sent me down the rabbit hole. So what I noticed, and it wasn't just this home, there were a lot of other homes out there. What I noticed at the time was anything under $750,000, it made sense to buy. Because anything under that amount, it was more expensive to rent than it was to buy. Anything over that amount is actually more expensive to buy than to own. So these big palatial mansions, I saw some of the market, it was like a $3 million property, you could have rented for like $5,000. I was like, sign me up, I'll do it for 10 years. Because when you really look at the numbers, as Doug was saying, there are things that people don't look at. They just look at it and say, what can I afford for my payment? Okay, well, let's run into the calculations. And for those of you who are interested, I'm putting links on the website to this episode when it comes out, and it has a link to all these posts. And one of them is a calculator. So I created this calculator so everyone could use it, because it's so important that people actually know the math between renting versus buying. So I put the calculator together basically so you can make it really easy. You put in a few inputs and it'll spit out the conclusion. And what you'll find, probably surprisingly to most of you, is that owning a home is not necessarily a good deal. As Robert Shiller said, I didn't see that, so I'm not going to say I got it from him because I didn't know about it. It was a really good article, but it was back in 1993, so he definitely got in front of me on that one. But the point is in doing the math, what you realize is, think about it, it's 6% in and out of a house. So it's going to cost you 6% of the home value to buy and sell it at one point or time or another. It's going to cost you about 1% a year for maintenance costs, for CapEx, as they call it, fixing a roof, fixing plumbing, whatever it is. It's about 1% of the home you're going to pay each year, not necessarily every year, but overall, it's going to be about 1% a year goes into CapEx or maintenance items, not fixing light bulbs, but like fixing the roof, fixing the driveway or whatever it is, approximately 1% a year. You also have the fact that you put 20% down. So you buy a $100,000 house, you put 20% down, you put down $20,000. Okay, great. Well, if the home price appreciates, let's say the home price goes up 5%, well, you just made $5,000. So your 20 turns into 25, which is 25%. Which is great. That's a great return, better than you get anywhere else. So leverage is really helpful. However, think about it. You're paying monthly interest and principal payments every month, and you're paying taxes, you're paying water bills, you're paying for maintenance, you're paying for all this stuff. And what you'll find if you really do the math properly is you're going to end up breaking even. It's not an investment. It's a personal expense. I tell this to everybody and people don't understand. Is a personal expense, not an investment. It's an emotional thing. If you or your spouse wants to buy the house because there's a beautiful tree in the backyard, that's an emotional decision. That's not a money decision. There's nothing wrong with it. You want to love the place you live. If you want to buy a house because it's a beautiful setting and the house is a dump, but the setting's beautiful and you can rehab the house, you're buying it on emotion. You're not buying it because it's practical. But that's okay because it's a personal expense. You can buy an ugly coat or a beautiful coat. I really don't care. It's a personal expense, right? It's money that you're putting to use because it's valuable to you. However, if you're looking at your home as an investment, which a lot of people do, you're missing the numbers. People say, yeah, but the money's going into the home. It's an investment. If I'm renting, I'm just throwing it away. You're throwing it away both sides. You just haven't done the math. So for instance, you know, I tell the audience, I'm renting right now. I used to own a home and I sold all my real estate last year because I saw the writing on the wall and I said, this is going to get ugly and I don't want to own real estate. So I sold everything last year and I got lucky because it took another day, probably wouldn't have got the same price because the rates went up. But anyway, so I'm renting and it costs me X amount a month, right? It costs me a certain amount a month. And what do I have to pay for? Well, I have to pay for electricity, internet, cable, which everybody has to do, whether you buy or rent. I don't have to pay for water or sewage. That in Massachusetts goes to the landlord. Landlord pays that. What about taxes? I don't have to pay taxes. The landlord pays the taxes. What about when the roof leaked? First year we got here, the roof leaked when we had an ice dam, water running all through the side. Oh crap, I got to go hire somebody to fix the house. Nope, call the landlord. You guys fix it. You got to shovel the driveway? Not my problem. Got to mow the lawn? Not my problem. So the point is all of these little things that add up over time are things that if you're renting, someone else takes care of versus me. If you own it, I've got to take care of it. Not only do I have to pay for it, but I have to have the hassle of dealing with it. Oh, I got to go hire a snowplow guy. I got to go hire a lawn maintenance person. I got to go hire this. I don't have to do any of it. Hello, landlord? Oh yeah, please take care of this instantly. Okay, you know, maybe it's not instant, but anyway, you get the point. So it's not only the money, but it's also the hassle. And I'm not renting permanently. I'm renting because real estate is so out of whack that to me, it's just I'm lighting money on fire if I didn't sell and I waited for real estate to drop, whatever, 20, 30% in Boston. The takeaway here, and this is kind of the learning you can take away this week, renting versus buying. Why do you think buying is important? You think it's important because our culture has embedded it in your head that homeownership equals success. Homeownership is getting your dream. The American dream is about homeownership. You know where the American dream started? Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. I forget which one it was. I think it was Fannie Mae was first. Fannie Mae started it. It was a commercial. The American dream of homeownership was started via a commercial. That's why we think that. You know why you brush your teeth and why you brush them with toothpaste? Because of a commercial. And the commercial started because the army was sick of getting people in with bad teeth and bad health and whatever it was. You go read, there's a book called The Power of Habit. They actually illustrate this whole thing. The whole reason we brush our teeth is because of a commercial. Not a bad thing, but that's why it started. Same thing with home ownership. Everyone wants to own a home. Is it a good idea? I don't know. You need to make that decision. The point is don't make the decision because you feel like it's going to make you feel successful. Nobody knows that I rent. Well, actually, everybody knows because everybody listens to this podcast and watches on YouTube. But everybody in my neighborhood, they don't know that. They just know I live here and we're neighbors. People aren't walking around saying, oh, do you own or rent? Oh, you rent? Oh, I can't talk to you. I mean, people have that in the back of your head. So I'm mentioning it because all the head trash that is in your own head is not actually real. Doug talked about reality and looking at reality. It's not a real thing. It's all in your head. It's only real if you make it real. Is it important that I rent versus buy? Not to me. I don't care. Money's money. And if I like the house, I like the house. My wife may have a different opinion. And for those of you who are married, you know that your opinion is at best half important. And for you guys, it's probably less than half important. But generally speaking, you need to understand that there's an emotional part of this and a logical or monetary part of this. I'm talking about the monetary part. I can't convince your spouse that this is not an emotional decision. That's your job. I really don't care. But the monetary decision, I want you to make good monetary choices. And if you decide to throw all that out the window and go emotional, that's your choice. And if you want to do that, I don't have a judgment. And I don't think anybody else will either. You need to pick what's right for you. But I bring it up because it's so important to understand how to think properly about finances. It's not about whether the emotional part kicks in. It's about whether you know you're being manipulated by the financial system, accidentally or deliberately, but you need to make good choices. And to make good choices, it means breaking things down and analyzing for yourself. Don't assume that these assumptions are accurate. They're not all accurate. We talk about on the show a lot, Wall Street half-truths. This is another half-truth. Homeownership versus renting. It doesn't matter. Whatever the numbers say is what matters. Do the math. So for those of you who are interested, you can go to our website. Actually, if you go to the moneytreepodcast.com website, we'll have a link to those episodes. You can learn more about all the stuff we just talked about. It's written out through three posts. It'll give you everything you need. Plus, if you sign up for the calculator, it will give all that to you and you can make your own decisions.
One quick thing on this. In an interview with Schiller in about 2013, he basically said, look, ultimately, he was asked, people trap their savings in a home. They're running an opportunity cost of not having the money liquid to earn a better return on the market. Why do it? He agreed. He said, the housing is traditionally not viewed as a great investment. It takes maintenance, depreciation, out of style. I talk about this all the time with planners. Opportunity cost. People always look at the cost that they're paying directly. They don't look at the opportunity cost of where their money is going. It's one of the reasons I have been very hesitant on financial planning of putting too much money into real estate. He talked about, look, all of these things go on into cost, but a great analogy for people that couldn't get it. He put out this analogy, which I think is awesome. It was not considered an investment until the early 2000s. Okay. That's a fad. That's when it became an investment. People were like, look, I'm going to maybe diversify, do other things, look at those things. He goes, but look, if you're having your hard time wrapping your head about this, because if you think investing in housing is such a great idea, why not invest in cars? Buy a car, mothball it, sell it in 20 years. And some classic cars for sure. But obviously it's not a good idea because people won't want your car. They won't want to sit on your early 90s Honda. They are going to want a newer car. And it's the same thing with houses. You can't sell a 30-year-old home that has 30-year-old roofing, 30-year-old carpet, 30-year-old kitchen appliances. Yeah, the home price might go up, but you're going to need to do maintenance and renovations, and that costs money. Again, is it the best place for you to park your money? I personally believe, and this goes back to the same thing about putting extra payments on your real estate. All you're doing is giving a free donation to the bank and giving your money away, because it is not going to get any rate of return on an extra payment on your property.
I want to just reiterate. So it was Fannie Mae who came up with the campaign. I want to show a chart that actually Doug provided to me earlier, which is the Case-Shiller home price. The Case-Shiller home price index is basically an index which tracks home prices. So this chart, it shows basically the chart of the home price index, which just kind of shows generally where home prices are going, compared to the CPI. And the CPI is basically what we use to track inflation. So if you'll notice here, things are kind of bumping along in the 70s and 80s and 90s, you know, up, down, up, down. And then you had this home price explosion. So starting around 2000, it just went up from 0.6 up to 1.93, it looks like, in the housing bubble. You might think, wow, that's a huge jump. That's like a 50% jump in the ratio. Now, this is not, and I put this out, that it's a ratio. So that what it means is if the home price is going up 5% and the CPI is going up 2%, then there's going to be a larger number. If you go back historically, hundreds of years, home prices and the inflation rate have been pretty much flatline. You have to think of it this way. For home prices, they're generally speaking going to mirror inflation over hundreds of years. So the last 20 have been a complete anomaly. But for the last few hundred years, home prices have basically mirrored inflation more or less for the appreciation factor. So when I talk about on the show, you don't want to buy real estate for appreciation, you buy it for cash flow. That's the reason. You can't predict appreciation. You can predict cash flow. So you don't want to try to predict things you can't predict. You'd rather focus on things you can predict. So if the home price and the CPI are going to mirror each other, then you can make certain expectations. However, if you look at this, what you'll notice is home prices far outpaced the rate of inflation. You know, the ratio doubled, which means home prices went up a lot more than inflation, because inflation was relatively high in the early 2000s before the crash. And then it went back down to a normal range of 0.6. And then it pretty much skyrocketed after that since. And it went as high as it looks like 1.1. And in comparison, historically, that's double what it was historically. So we talk a lot about the show because I hear a lot of people coming on, and there was, I forget the guy's name. I wanted to get him on the show. He's really big in the mortgage space. He's very well known, really smart guy. But as a thought leader in the space, he has a lot of incentive to have the space look good. So, you know, I take this with a grain of salt, but he said, no, all this stuff, we had one bad month of bad numbers where the median home price dropped. That's nothing to be concerned about. I'd say, well, the writing's on the wall. We're already there. It's just a matter of when. So when you have data points, so the reason I'm showing you this data point is to show you the historical context of everything I'm talking about and Doug is talking about every single week, how it's unaffordable. The affordability rate is off the charts still, even still. We talk about all these metrics. And what I hear coming back from very smart people, I'm not disrespecting people who have this opinion because these people are really bright. Many of them are smarter than me. However, on this point, I can make the point really simply, and they don't have an answer, which is their point is, well, there's more supply and there's not enough demand. Not enough new houses are being built and there's more people coming into the market. So it's squeezing the prices up. I'd say, yeah, that's a silly comparison, because if that was true, then why did they go way up? Why did they go way down? It's a nonsense comparison. Does it matter over the long term? Absolutely. It makes sense in the 10, 20, 30-year cycle. It is going to have an influence. Is it going to matter in the one-year cycle? Absolutely not. Because unless there are bands of people roaming around without houses, which doesn't exist except for California, and that has nothing to do with need. That has to do with desire to sit under a bridge, you know, or other things. I don't want to demean homeless people. I'm sure there's other reasons. But the point is there's no bands of people running around without home. So there is no lack of homes out there. But there is a problem with affordability. So I'm not a good example of what other people are doing. I'm renting because I think things are going to get crazy and home prices are going to drop a lot. That's not normal. I'm not normal. I don't claim to be normal. Most people own a home and they're just going to bump from one home to another. So at the end of the day, it's six of one, half dozen the other. But in general, if you look at the statistics here, it should be obvious to you that there's something out of balance. And when things get out of balance one way, they tend to go out of balance in the opposite direction. We call it reversion to the mean. Think about it this way. You're in the ocean, you got a beach ball. You hold the beach ball underwater, it pops up. And it doesn't just go to the surface, it pops way up in the air. The deeper you hold it, the higher it's going to pop up in the air, because basically reversion to the mean, eventually the beach ball sits on top of the water, but it doesn't right away. It bounces up and then goes down and up and down, and then eventually it flatlines. The same principle holds true for a lot of different markets. 2000, 2007, you could say 2020, I don't really want to, but you look at these balances where things get out of control in one direction. 2000, it went out of control in the other direction, things dropped. And then it went out of control in the other direction, went up. So we are in these markets that are a little bit crazy and hyper volatile. And in part because starting in, you know, around 2000, when the Fed started pumping money into the system and inflate everything, now we've got this bullwhip effect, which you could argue whether it's the bullwhip effect, it's effectively the same result. You might have had a relatively normalized economy, and then you print a bunch of money and it just starts going crazy with the volatility. That's the piece that, you know, people say, well, it's money printing. No, it's just creating more volatility because it's a misallocation of resources. So what it means is there's more money, so people have to adjust for the more money. And if there's less money, they have to adjust for that. But those adjustments adjust in large directions, one way or the other. And eventually it resets and goes the other way. But the point I'm trying to make is we're showing you these charts to influence you on the fact that you need to understand what's going on. These are really important trends. These are not minor bumps like the stock market is going to go up 2% or down 2% tomorrow. This is decades long trends that once you see this, and like I said, if you're not watching this live or you're going to LinkedIn to see it or you're on YouTube, go to the website and this chart will be there. It shows you this is a 50-year chart. 50-year chart shows an enormous imbalance in the markets right now. And if I was a Star Wars fan, which I am, there's an imbalance in the force right now, Doug. It's getting me a little uneasy.
I expanded this back to all time looking at the chart. And if you go back to the beginning of the chart, which goes back to around 1889, the home prices CPI ratio hit 0.58 in 1893. It actually declined from there down to a low of 0.31 around 1920, and it held steady. Guess what? From that 0.58 in 1893, guess when the next time it hit 0.58 as a ratio again, Kirk?
When, Doug?
Wasn't until roughly around 1988. So it took almost 100 years to get the ratio back up. And then it dipped back down, didn't hit it again until, what did we say? 2000, which it went into the bubble. And after the bubble, it crashed back down to about 0.6 and has risen again. So if you look at this, it is clearly evident for anybody out there that is being caught up. And we've got 2 to 3 generations who have lived their entire life inside of this clear anomaly since 2000. And so they don't know anything different. And when you look around and you see all of this incredible appreciation on real estate during that time, you might be inclined to think that this is the norm. But over 130, 140 years, you can see that this is just an anomaly since 2000, which again correlates to what, Kirk? An incredible level of loose monetary policy.
So I want to kind of touch on more of this because there's a lot of imbalance in the force, if you will, going on right now. So that's just one piece. Now, we also have other featured stories, which are also in the news, Doug, you were nice enough to send, which is the California mansion tax. Now, I've been seeing this for the last 2 weeks of all these celebrities trying to sell their mansions and fire sale their mansions because there's going to be a tax. I think one of the features here was Kobe Bryant trying to sell at a reduced price of $38 million if he doesn't sell by basically tomorrow. There's going to be an additional $2 million basically extracted from him. I don't know all the terms and maybe you can get into it, Doug, but the challenge with this is you have a lot of hands being kind of laid out. And this is one of my concerns about real estate in a bear market is you own real estate. You can't go anywhere. You're done. You own it like California. People can't sell their homes because you need to have somebody to buy the home. well, I don't want to buy a California mansion and pay $2 million just because I bought it. That's ridiculous. But this is what people want to do. They want to get out. They want to get out from under the thumb of the dictatorial government of places like California. And I don't only want to pick on California because every other state's doing it. Massachusetts just instituted over $1 million in income. You're getting an excess tax. Maryland did this, I think it was about 10 years ago, and they lost 85% of their millionaires when they instituted a millionaire's tax. So these governments are going to figure it out. Everyone's going to leave. And then they're going to say, sorry, we made a mistake. Please come back. And people are going to give them the middle finger and say, sorry, I'm across the border in Nevada and you can go pound sand. What are your thoughts? This is a big deal for people in California.
It's a perfect example of, I think a good analogy is the post office. We've seen places where there's population increases, population declines. California has been one of those places we're starting to see a downturn trend on population. I live in Minnesota. We're starting to see a lot of people that have migrated away from the state that were snowbirds and now they're all year birds. The post office, what happened? People started using less postage stamps. So what do? They raised the prices to try to make up for people spending less revenue on the post office. And that just makes people spend even less because they're like, looking at it. Now I can send something on FedEx overnight for not much more than I can go and send it through the post office. And who knows when it's going to arrive, but now they've jacked up the price of postage. The more expensive you make it, trying to make up for the loss of top line revenue, any business realizes this. The more you're trying to make up for top line revenue by raising your prices, the more you're going to drive more people away. And there's a strategic way of doing it. And then there's unfortunately the downward tailspin. What California is doing here is they've effectively told everybody, look, if you have over a $5 million house, and this isn't California, this is LA County specifically, is telling you you're going to basically pay a tax on the value of your house, which as we have just discussed is quite arbitrary, right, Kirk? It has nothing to do with what people are willing to pay. Where I live, I've been battling the county for 2-3 years since I bought the house. I paid basically around $150,000 less than the county says my house is worth. And I've said to the county, I say, look, how can you tell me what it's worth? They said, well, that's what it's worth. I said, but that's what I paid. Isn't the transaction the actual determination of value? Of course it is. It's what person A and person B have decided that it was worth to make that transaction. The county says, no, arbitrarily, we think it's this. So who's coming up with that $5 million valuation that they're going to be taxing people on? And so as we've already concluded in previous conversations, Kirk, we are already starting to see a decline in housing prices in certain markets that have been highly appreciated. Now we're also starting to see, and we'll come back to this, vacancy increases, significant vacancy increases in certain markets. Around the Super Bowl, Phoenix had a tremendous number of homes and apartments or whatever it was listed for Airbnb in order to rent to people going to the Super Bowl. It got so bad with vacancies that coming up to the Super Bowl, these places that have been put on the market for $1,500 or $3,000 a month for the rental for the Super Bowl were so desperate to get anybody, they were dropping the renting pricing down to like $300 and they still couldn't rent them. That short-term boost in vacancies has not gone down. They're starting to see that these vacancies are becoming more permanent. And that was based off of, again, we're starting to see more rental, more apartments being built. We're seeing record levels of apartments being built. Over the last couple of years, there's been plenty of REITs that have been created and other types of investment platforms to invest money to go out and solve the housing shortage. So they're building tons of apartments for people to rent. You add that increasing number of volume and supply to a market that's already starting to see some cracks, where people that had already done a tremendous number of investment housing, we've talked about how these investment companies have gone in, bought up houses. I mean, Zillow went into this a couple of years ago. They had bought all of these houses up and they had to dump them because they could not sell them for what they wanted. It was not becoming a good investment. Now you start to see a little bit of a slowdown. You start to see more people that, you know, are in houses with low interest rates. Like maybe they got a mortgage at 2.5%. They don't want to move. They're sitting there like, I got a house at 2.5%. If I sell this house, now I've got to go out and buy a 6% home. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sell the house. And maybe if I have to move, I might rent somewhere else and then try to rent my house because I don't want to sell it. Well, guess what? That's more vacancies. Now you go and you exacerbate the problem by telling all of these people that after this deadline, we're going to assess you a $2 million tax on an arbitrary evaluation of your home. So now in LA County, you're going to now have a flooding, and we're starting to see it, of houses at the higher level that are trying to desperately sell their house, whatever they can. In this article, it was actually talking about someone willing to take a loss on their purchase in order to avoid getting out before that tax gets assessed. Again, to pay the tax, you got to have the liquidity. So they're willing to take a loss in the house to create the liquidity to not have to pay the tax, to have the money in hand. It's telling you at the top level, once again, some of the things that I've talked about is that your house, yeah, whether it's an investment home or property or residential property, guess what? Equity is arbitrary. Equity is only what people are willing to pay you to sell it or what the bank is willing to give you based on your price. And again, they're usually only going to rent to you or loan to you based off your income. Mortgages are not a loan against your house. They're a loan against your income secured by your house. And the bank gets to determine how much of that value is securable. So all of a sudden, you're dealing with a situation in which they're showing you right now, they would rather take the liquidity and get it out of the house than pay the tax because the house is illiquid. It is not something you can use to buy food, to buy clothing, to do the things you want to do. Equity is completely arbitrary. And now when the county comes along and says, we're going to charge you $2 million for that, well, guess what? Now there's going to be another reason to increase supply against an already very stalled demand. And that they're not going to be alone in this. We're seeing this in other areas as well.
Hey, Doug, did you hear? We're giving away free money. Well, I'll tell you about it in a bit. There's a saying in the mining community. Well, precious metals mining, that is. The saying is that if you want the best deals, you have to be in the room. Now, you're probably thinking, what does it mean to be in the room? Well, I'll tell you. Being in the room means that you're on the short list of people who get invited to be a part of the best deals. These are the deals that most investors will never have access to. You mean like IPOs? Nope. IPOs are chump change. Those are for retail investors, small potatoes. That's nothing compared to these deals. These deals would have you salivating to get access to them. Once you know they exist, you will never look at investing the same way again. I almost don't want to tell you they exist because it'll ruin your thinking of how the investing world really works. Now, you might be excited that these deals exist, but you only have access to the deals if you're an insider or in the room, as they call it. As loyal listeners of the show, I'm going to give you a chance to be in the room. Money Tree Investing Podcast has created the Insiders Club. This is a community of our show's members who are loyal listeners of the show and want to get more out of their investing experience. Being a part of the Insiders Club gives you insider status for upcoming events and private webinars, discounts, free stuff and books, and influence on the future direction of the show. This is an opportunity to join us as we expand our content and services. Oh, did I mention you're getting free money? Yes, in the next few weeks, I will be giving free money to members of the Insiders Club as my appreciation for listening to the show. There's no cost to join the Insiders Club. Just go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money. Do that today to join the community. That's moneytreepodcast.com/free money. I hope to see you in the room. I'm going to touch on a few things, and I want to actually make a comment here because I think it's really important. I was looking at this post, and a lot of people are posting to it, and it seems to, like everything else, be a political issue. People are supporting this. And
no way. My hair color is a political issue this morning, Kirk. I mean, that's just the world we live in now.
Here's my point is that, and somebody actually did this and they drew it along political lines. I'm not going to say this, but you can draw your own conclusions. Is one party tends to be more focused on the results and less so on the unintended consequences. And the other one tends to be more focused on the unintended consequences. So I say this because it made me think when they made the comment, because I hadn't really thought of it that way, is that one side is more focused on the issue and the other is focused on the unintended consequences. Here's an unintended consequence of a mansion tax. Having millionaires move out of the state, that is a consequence, right? We talked about that. Here's another one. And I want to say this with a caveat because California school systems don't operate this way. But California school systems, when you sell a house, whatever that price is, that is your tax based on that. If you buy a house 50 years ago, you're paying taxes based on 50 years ago home prices. Massachusetts, they revalue it every 2 years. So we don't have that benefit. But this is a problem in California schools because the prices went up and the schools aren't getting the benefit of that appreciation in a home price. And I forget the rule. Somebody in California can send in a chat. Let me know what it's called. But it's a prop 2.5, or I don't know what it is. But anyway, maybe that's around here. It's 2.5. the point is there's something there. The problem is if home prices go down in price, now you're getting less in school taxes. Now, I mention this because around here in Massachusetts, if home prices go from $3 million down to $1 million, now you have a, you know, whatever, 66% reduction in tax. Well, I think it's like 75-80% of the town taxes go to the schools. So you want to talk about a real problem. Schooling in this country is already a slow motion train wreck hitting a dumpster fire. If you look at the result of this, they still barely are paying the teachers. And I want to be really clear, the teachers' unions is a problem where the teachers themselves are not a problem, but the unions can be a problem, or at least have been. But teachers aren't getting paid enough. Let's be honest. We're having a crappy educational system and the teachers aren't being paid enough. And I couldn't blame them if they don't really want to teach, because I don't want to spend a lot of time for free. But at the end of the day, they're going to get paid even less, which means that the school systems are going to get less. There's going to be less computers, less infrastructure, all of the stuff that there's being built that is great and is going to accelerate education and give people access to online resources. That's all going to stop if you don't have money. So what's going to happen with schools? Well, A, they're not going to be able to afford it because taxes are going to go down, which, let's all be honest here, the home prices go down, the taxes won't drop until people start complaining and say, well, my home price isn't really worth this much, so you got to drop it. So not everybody will benefit because they don't know you can appeal your taxes. But the home price is going to drop, and that's going to be a problem. So what else is going to happen? Well, these towns aren't going to have any money to pay for stuff they've already allocated, so they're going to have to go borrow. They're going to go borrow money. They're going to go in the open market, go to Goldman, JP, and Morgan, and they're going to say, hey, I need to borrow money. I need a municipal loan so we can fund our school systems. Well, they'll happily do that and raise money, but at some point, the town's no longer going to be able to support the debt. So what's going to happen? Well, it's just going to be this negative spiral of there's not enough money out there to support what they already have. And a lot of towns are going to have significant financial problems. This is an unintended consequence. People are going to stand up and scream 5-10 years from now and say, it's because this party did this. It's because this party did that. I'm telling you right now, this is what is going to cause that. This plus the recession. The recession is not, it's not really based on who's in power. Let's be honest. The recession is a recession. You can blame, but the recession happens anyway. But if you really want to talk about what's going to knock prices down, this is one of those things that's going to happen. And they're going to say it's something else because it was 5-10 years ago. It's not. This is one of the things that's going to contribute to it. So I want to move on in the interest of time because we got 9 minutes. I do want to get into banking. And Doug, I want you to talk about banking because right now the FDIC is considered forcing big banks to pay up after the $20 billion hit. I'm actually of two minds about this, Doug, but what are your thoughts?
I guess one side of it, if the big banks are going to consider to be too big to fail and they are removed from all of the risks that the average bank around the world, or at least in America, would have to face, then guess what? It probably is a little bit of a price of a pay to play to do that. But again, the question really comes down to me, goes back to a bigger issue of that is we already had FDIC minimums. We already had regulation in place to be able to create some reserves and to protect people. And we watered down the regulations starting in 1999. We've already seen numerous examples. We went 80 some years without a bank failure. And now look at it, since 2000, we've had, I mean, you saw the circle. We either have it or we put it up several weeks ago where it shows all the bank failures that have ever occurred. And almost all of those bank failures, A, they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And B, almost all of them are since 2000. A lot of them happened during the crash and Great Recession of 2007. We basically watered down the regulations that kept things in check. We've obviously clearly seen that the banks don't give a dang about prudent banking management. The funny thing is that as a business owner, you rely on banks to give you money and they want to know that you're running your business okay. And then they're going to determine whether or not to give you this money. And that's getting harder and harder to get. And maybe they'll give you the money if the Small Business Administration is willing to back them up. But as we look and pull back the covers, kind of like, you know, the old Warren Buffett thing. You don't know who's swimming naked till the tide goes out. Listen, if we were to pull back the covers on these banks, they run their businesses worse than any small business owner without a half a mind could ever run it. They don't know what they're doing. They keep making the same investment decisions poorly over and over. And guess what happens? Then it screws up. Then they blame their consumers. And unfortunately, now what we've gotten is instead of letting this reset and fix with pain, the problem that comes from a free market society, the problem that comes from having pulled back the regulation from the regulators, the problem that comes from making poor business decisions, and letting that reset and teach everybody a lesson, they just keep kicking the can down the road. Kick the can down the road. Kick the can down the road. So yeah, they're going to charge these big banks, which is probably a good thing because the big banks, they can do whatever they want. We won't let them fail. Well, now they're not letting the smaller banks fail. And the big banks are going to have to take on some cost of that. But if we don't let anybody fail, if we continue to like fix debt with more debt, our federal government does it. The average consumer does it. And now what happened with FDIC? Well, we've got our FDIC limits, but if they fail and exceed that, now we're going to be able to create another lending of a short-term loan to fix that. We are never getting to a point in which we are creating rigid barriers, sticking to those barriers. We keep moving the goalposts. I think, Kirk, you and your family grew up playing sports. I've played sports. You know, some people can't stand sports analogies, but there's a reason we keep using it because it's a tangible way you can look and say and understand what's going on in one aspect to another. Moving the goalpost does not work in sports. If you keep changing the rules, if you keep moving the goalposts, you can never score. You can never finish the game. And unfortunately, at some point, and this probably started with going off the gold standard, we've talked about that, we've created an arbitrary problem that is now leading to another conversation. What's going on with the dollar as the world reserve? Guys, this is a major, major problem for the United States monetary policy, the banking system. And there's going to be, again, unintended consequences of continuing to move the goalposts.
All right. Let's talk about a few things here. I want to address this and I want to touch on one thing really quickly first, which is we talk about housing prices. I think this is really important. This is basically, home price declines by city. Nationally, they're down about 5% from the post-pandemic peak, as according to Case-Shiller, which we referenced earlier. Mortgage rates have more than doubled, and the home price declines already. San Francisco's down 17, Seattle 16, San Diego 12, you know, down to Boston's down 6. So New York's only down 2. So the price declines are starting. And, you know, you could argue whether they're going to continue. You might say, oh, it's a blip. And I'd say, well, as long as interest rates are high, it's not a blip. But I just wanted to show what we've been talking about for the last 2 years is finally starting to happen. And everyone needs to wake up that this is going to happen. If you think it's just going to be a blip, it's not. Just wanted to point that out. Now, I want to move on here because, you know, we talked about the banks and forcing to pay up. Honestly, I think the whole banking system is a bit of a mess. You know, if you want the big banks to pay for the smaller banks, whatever. You know, the big problem I have with corporate America right now is that big institutions are basically monopolies now. So anytime there's a blow up, well, we just saw SVB blew up, the second largest bank blow up. So you have a blow up and what happens? All new regulations come in because, hey, we can't have any more blow ups. So what happens? More regulations. Well, who benefits from regulations? Well, the big banks benefit from regulations. Now you might think they're the perpetrators. They should be paying more and there should be more regulation. Well, that's fine on the surface, but what actually happens? Take Sarbanes-Oxley, take any of these, right? What did Sarbanes-Oxley do? They said, oh, we want to protect people from companies and blowing up and all that. Well, what happened? Well, the big companies don't care because there's like, great, we'll hire a department. They'll take care of Sarbanes-Oxley. We'll be great. What do smaller companies do? Oh, we got to hire 10 more people. I don't have 10 more people. I don't have money for 10 more people. What are we going to do? Well, now we got to hire them because otherwise we'll be out of compliance. So now our profit margins shrink. So the big companies, it's literally a drop in the bucket and they don't care. Smaller companies, it makes a difference. So any of these new regulations and rules, all they do is protect the big companies. And people out there say, no, we need to go after the big companies. All you're doing is supporting the monopolies, the ones you're actually against. This is what we talked about earlier, unintended consequences. When you're going after big companies, you create unintended consequences that effectively support the big companies. And why does this happen? Who do you think's paying all the politicians? It's not Kirk. Doug and I. We don't have enough money to pay these people, and I wouldn't pay him anyway. Go ahead, Doug.
Here's another perfect example. About, I don't know, a couple years ago, people listening may remember when all of the big IT companies were going in front of Congress. You had Facebook and Google and all of them were brought before talking about internet safety and all that. Zuckerberg was at the front of the cover. Yeah, we need internet safety. We need to protect these people. It's like, why would he want internet regulation? Because they're already the big dog. Right. Google's already the big dog. Amazon's already the big dog. They're already the big dog. Internet regulation now, after God knows plenty of stories about how Facebook has, I mean, let's face it, the social network, there's, or whatever the one is that's out there on Netflix that talks about the impact of social media. Facebook went all through all this stuff. Now they want regulation. Why? Because it's going to keep their competition at bay. Once they get that big, of course they want the regulation in then. It's just like what you're talking about. It just made me think of it. It's exact same example, Kirk.
So let's touch on it and we can wrap it up because I know we're coming up on time here. Is I want to talk about the U.S. reserve currency status, which it both is and isn't a big deal. I say this because in essence, it really is a big deal, but I think people don't fully understand how it works. So we wanted to touch on it a little bit here because I think it's a really important concept and we're not going to get too much into the weeds. We can get into that later because frankly, we don't have the time or run out of it, but I think it's an important enough topic and it is in the news. So this is a chart of the world foreign exchange reserves. Okay. So you can think of like foreign exchange reserves. This is like the percentage that every country has. Now, if you look at this, this is a percentage of world traffic that goes through a certain currency. So basically what this means is there's a certain amount of, if you look at global trade, this is the percentage of global trade that is exchanged through these currencies. Now, you'll notice that over time, you look at like the Japanese yen was high and then it declined and now it's creeping up again. The renminbi was non-existent. Now it's getting something. The British pound's been more or less the same. The euro kind of has gone up and down, but the US dollar has been declining over the last 20 years. So we say this because here's the thing. There's two sides to this. People think the US is going to lose the world's reserve currency status. What does that mean? Well, there's benefits and there's drawbacks. Basically, what happens is when somebody wins a world war, which is kind of what happened, right? You win a world war, you can dictate the terms. And US decided to dictate the terms that we're going to have the world's global reserve currency. What does that mean? The whole world has to do business in dollars. Now, the US dollar is a very deep and liquid market. Now, people say, oh, the Chinese are going to come in and they're going to beat us to it and they're going to take the world's reserve currency status. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, let them have it. But they don't have the deep and liquid markets that the US has. They are a managed market. This is not a true economy. You have a dictatorial economy. You have basically a top-down, here's what we're going to do this quarter. We're going to do 5% growth. And everyone figures out a way to make 5% growth happen, whether it did or not. It is not a transparent market. It is not a trustworthy market. And quite frankly, after the few years, you can see with the Chinese what they did to their entrepreneurs. They basically stuck them in a jail cell and, what do they call them, reconditioned them, or they re-education? But the point is, if you look at the US dollar, you don't have to like it. You can say, well, the US is doing more harm than good. I don't really care, right? That's for someone else to decide. I do care, but it's not for this conversation. The point is if you have everyone doing business in dollars, effectively it supports the strength of the dollar. If we lose that status, basically it means other people are not going to be doing business in dollar, which means we've got a lot of extra dollars out there that need to go somewhere. And that means you'd have like overnight hyperinflation. Now, that's not going to happen because U.S. is out there, you know, bartering deals with other countries and doing things. But the big question is, what else is going to happen? If it's not going to be the dollar, who is it going to be? It's not the euro. It's not the renminbi. It's not the yen. It's not the pound. As they say, we're the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry. I say this to impress upon you that this is not an overnight thing. This will probably have to happen after a war, and it would involve us losing the war if that were to happen. If we did, then we would have to worry. But as long as we didn't lose the war, then we really don't have as much to worry about. So the benefit is we can demand things. We can demand things. The drawback is we have to police it. We're the world's police. Remember, it was a Team USA, that movie, the hilarious movie with the minionettes. And it was like, you know, Team America, I think is what it was called.
Team America. Yep.
It was like Team America World Police. I mean, it was hilarious. These guys, Matt and Trey Parker.
Written by the founders of South Park.
Exactly. Yeah, they did a great job with that. It was hilarious. But the point is we're the world's global police. But we have to police the seas. We have to police all this because we're trying to protect this trade hegemony, if you will. Now, the downside to all this, you might say, well, this is great. We can protect the world. The downside of this is we have to protect the world. It was like 30, 40% of our GDP goes to the military.
Everybody wants us to protect them until they don't want us to protect them. Right. It's a no-win situation.
But however, here's the other thing. What we've been doing for the last 20 years is we've been outsourcing our inflation to other countries. So we've had inflation, but because of globalization, we've outsourced that to Vietnam, China, India, and other places. So we haven't talked about inflation for a while. So I'm going to take a minute or two to talk about it, and then we'll move on. And we'll wrap up the show. Is part of the reason that we've had low inflation for the last 20 years is because of globalization. So instead of hiring a U.S. employee at $50 an hour to do a job, we've hired a Chinese employee to do it for $50 a month. So all these big companies, they can save on costs and they can pass those cost savings on to us as consumers. So we've had the benefit of low price inflation for two decades because of this globalization. Because of COVID, that globalization has reversed and has forced that inflation back to the U.S., which is what we're seeing now. So this is why we say inflation's not going away. It has very little influence on money printing. It makes all the difference on globalization and wage inflation now.
I want you to say that again, Kirk, because I think people have got to continuously hear this. Inflation has, half-truth, some to do with money printing, but there is this unbelievable belief out there that the only reason we have inflation is all the money printing. And if that was the case, we would have huge inflation after the QE of 2008. It didn't happen. What you're touching on is really critical. Inflation is not because we printed more money.
I'm going to take that as an opportunity to take us home here, but that's true. It's not primarily because of that. It has an influence. So Doug, let's take us home because we're running late here and we've got other calls and we got to run. So where can people find more about you?
Well, let's talk about that printing of money. And nothing seems to print more money than colleges. They're definitely the black box of capitalism and figure out every angle. Over the last 20, 25 years, a lot of the things that people believed or went through with college has changed. People that got full ride scholarships back 20 years ago are not seeing this come through with their kids, although they have this belief, this half-truth. You know, this is a game and it's being worked against you. They're continuing to make it harder and harder to get money, but there are ways. In addition to that, most people are familiar with some of the worst ways to pay for college. And I say that because there's no bad way to pay for college other than the cost itself. But Dan, if all you're doing is saving into 529 plans, those 529 plans could be costing you from getting all of the discounts and scholarships you deserve. You may be playing right into the game of the oligopolies, of the monopolies, of how 529s were set up to make other people rich and to give all of that money to the schools. There's actually multiple ways to pay for college. 30% of people that ask for more money get it through appeals. There's ways to play the game to get the schools and pit the schools against each other. Most people don't know this. If you're doing this yourself, if you're just reading blogs, talking to other families, if you're picking schools because of team fandom and what you think is the cheapest way, you're probably leaving tons of money on the table. It's costing you more. And in the end, it may not be the right school anyway. If you want to learn how to play the game to even the playing field, if you want to learn how to really get the money, if you want to learn how to really pay for college the right way, then you need to start by getting your information now and getting it from the right sources. Go to procollegeplanners.com. Download our free checklist right now of what the real numbers are. Start to learn. You can also get our free college aid report, our free CAP report. Go to our website, procollegeplanners.com. Start the process. Have a conversation with us. Because if you don't, you're probably paying more money than you should. It's that simple. There are ways to get it done. And 95% of the people out there aren't going to take advantage of doing it the right way and pay more than they should and have probably a mediocre experience. Come get the help. This is way too complex to just try to surf 1,000 websites and get general answers. Talk to us today, procollegeplanners.com.
Great. Thanks for coming on, Doug. And that's the show for this week. Thank you again for joining us, Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to our show notes, resources, and the archive shows. So don't forget, do your own research. This show is for informational use only. We're not telling you what to think, merely how to think about investing. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.